Hello everyone, Tomasz here, and yes, it has been a while. Let's be honest here, it has been a couple of months. But it is for real now. The Fujilove podcast is back, and it will be landing in your podcast application every second week from now on. For starters, to celebrate the relaunch of the podcast, I have a very special guest for you today. Fujifilm ex-photographer from Belgium and Adobe Photoshop Lightroom certified expert, Mr. Piet van den Einde. Piet is a travel photographer himself. He is very well known for his flash photography as well. But today I will be talking with Piet about Adobe Lightroom and Fujifilm X RAW and JPEG files. There is very much extremely valuable information in this episode today, so without any further ado, let's dive straight into my conversation with Piet van den Einde.
This is Fujilove, a podcast for Fujifilm X users from around the globe. Your weekly dose of photography inspiration and all possible Fuji X-related goodness. Thank you for tuning in.
So, hey, Piet, how are you doing this morning?
I am fine, Tomasz, and you?
Yeah, everything good. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know it, you are pretty busy yourself.
Yeah, well, we're all busy, I think.
So. With all your projects and, you know, websites and tutorials and workshops, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe just in two sentences. I mean, some of our readers, Fujilove magazine readers, already know about you because you started with your Fujilove Academy videos. Mm-hmm. But for those of our listeners who may be listening to you for the first time, just In two, three sentences, could you tell us who you are, what you are doing?
Okay, so, well, I'm a Belgian photographer. I'm a Fujifilm ambassador for Fujifilm Belgium. I am also an ex-photographer. I guess one goes with the other or something. And the thing I love most is travel photography and mainly travel portraiture. I use a lot of flash in my work, and I'm also a Lightroom certified expert. So I do, and that's what you have got me for in the Fujilove
Academy
tutorials and the Academy. So I'll be doing lots of Lightroom and maybe the occasional Photoshop in there.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was actually, yeah, exactly. It was one of the main reasons, or the main reason I thought about working with you, because so many people getting the Fujifilm cameras, you know, they kind of compare the files, they get the files into Lightroom, and then they start looking, and there are differences, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are for sure some differences. But maybe before we go into it, I wanted to ask you, because I was wondering myself, so you are officially called the Adobe Photoshop Lightroom Certified Expert.
Yes,
is that
that's
correct?
A mouthful, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a mouthful. Yeah. What does it exactly mean? Did you receive training from Adobe, or
no,
how does it work?
I train myself, and the best way actually to train yourself is to write a book about the software, because then you really know everything by the end you've written the book. Mm-hmm. But no, the certification, Adobe has certified teachers, which I am not, but I am a certified expert. And that basically means that I have completed a test that Adobe makes on their different applications. You can be an InDesign certified expert, Photoshop certified expert. So I have taken the certification test for Lightroom, and that entitles you to using the logo and the title of certified expert. Now, it's a pretty tough test. I mean, if you just are a basic Lightroom user, you'll probably fail, and you should fail, because otherwise it wouldn't say much about the quality.
I would fail.
Yeah, well, but in a way it's a good standard, and the main reason I took the test is just so that I have the logo, let's say, but it doesn't really, for example, verify if you are the quality of your post-processing. It just verifies if you know where all the buttons and the labels are in Lightroom, and if you know the procedure, but it doesn't check anything else. That's just, you know, years of hands-on experience, I would say.
And now with all the updates which Adobe is coming with, do they repeat the test?
They had one on Lightroom 4 and then 5 and then 6, which I've taken. And now with the CC, so with the subscription model, well, it's been a while since there's been a new test, and I kind of wonder how they will go about it in the future. But generally, these tests, they lag a little bit behind. So I think the Lightroom 6 certification came out when Lightroom 6 was already maybe a year or so, or a year and a half in the running. Mm-hmm. And up until when there's a new test announced, and you can still, use the old certification even for the new application.
Okay, so you don't have to like state you are a CC expert or
well, sixth. If for example I would do the if there would be a new test and I would not take it or I would fail the new test for a new version of Lightroom, let's say Lightroom 7, I don't even know mm-hmm. if that's ever gonna happen or not, I don't know, but and I would fail that test or I wouldn't take it, then I could still call myself an Adobe Lightroom 6 certified expert.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, looking at Lightroom, I would say I am a intermediate kind of advanced user of Lightroom. Yeah, I was like looking at the interface, at Lightroom, and I started going, just before recording the podcast with you, I started going into actually deeper into the menus and into the, several panels. Yeah, there are many things, mm-hmm. An average user, I think, is not even aware of.
Yeah.
And maybe things that could actually help with, really help with achieving something new mm-hmm. with your images. So it's, respect if you know all this,
Well, I don't know all of it, but I know like 95%. And the other 5%, I know where I can find it online, because you can't know 100% about it. Even an application as relatively simple and small as Lightroom is still very deep, and there's so many little nooks and crannies in the program that, like you say, very few people ever use. And one of the things I actually like to teach during workshops and in my books and everything is that it is so much more than just a raw converter, because that's what people use it for 90% of the time. But there's also the whole library and database management aspect, which is hugely important.
Absolutely. I love this part. Love this part of this. Yeah. I mean, and I couldn't live without it today.
And a lot of people completely underuse that aspect. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that it's also a publication application. For example, you can make slideshows in Lightroom without ever having to leave the application. When I do before and afters for my presets, for example, I just make them in Lightroom because in the slideshow module, because it's relatively basic, but it gets the job done.
Right, you can create books, right?
Books, with Blair. My I have a couple of photo books. Like I just made a new one with only X-Pro2 images, because I wanted to give that to Fujifilm Belgium so they can use it when they are doing demos and stuff with the new 24 megapixel sensor is capable of. And I literally did that book in Lightroom. So first of all, I edited my images, of course, in the develop module. Then I filtered on X-Pro2 images only in the library module. I created a new collection, which I called Photo Book. I added some of the filter results into that collection. Then I went to the book module, and I could even automatically add the EXIF info, like, the shutter speed and whatnot, and the lens used, automatically at the bottom of my images. And the whole process took me like an hour or so, whereas if I would have to use a separate database application and then another book application, it would have cost me a day.
Right, and they are working with Blurb, right?
Okay,
and you're happy with the quality?
I'm happy with the quality. I mean, there are obviously better books out there. Like, for example, I have a book made by the people from Asuka Book, and it's definitely better, but it's also three times the price. So it, I would expect it to be better.
Right.
But there's one, if I, there's one tip I can give the people who listen to this podcast, that is, even if you don't like to subscribe to newsletters, if you want to make books with Lightroom, subscribe to the Blurb newsletter. And what will happen is they're really a little bit spammy. They send like two emails a week sometimes, but a lot of those emails contain offers for discounts, and they can go all the way up to 50%. On average, it's like 30-35%, sometimes it's 40, and sometimes it's even 50. And the only problem with these offers is that they generally last only like 3 days or so.
Okay, so you have to act quickly.
Yeah, but what I do is basically I make my book whenever I have a free moment, and then I save it in Lightroom. You can save a book that you've laid out in as a saved book, and then it's just sitting in my Lightroom catalog. And then whenever I get an update from Blurb that there's a discount,
you run to your computer.
I run to my computer, and I just have to, you know, get the saved book, which takes a second, and upload it and use the discount code. And it saved me a lot of money. And really, if you can use the discount code, I think their price to quality ratio is very good.
Mm-hmm. Great. This is a great tip. Okay, great. Let's go on to the actual, you know, topic of Fujifilm X files, RAW files, as well as JPEGs and Lightroom.
Mm-hmm.
Do Fuji files and Lightroom actually like each other, in your opinion?
Well, they are getting to know each other better, I'd say. at the start, it was really, it was bad, but you just have to, you know, Google that, and I mean, it was really bad.
I remember those times. Like, yeah. Everybody was complaining.
There was a smearing of foliage, anything green, you know.
Exactly.
That has improved a lot. I would say it's probably by the default settings, it's probably still not the best default result that you would get in Lightroom, and you compare it to other RAW converters. But for me, at least, and I mean, I print, you know, large formats, 30 by 60 centimeters in my photo books. And Fujifilm has printed even larger format prints that were processed in Lightroom. And to me, it's good enough, especially if you consider that there's other things that work too. I mean, come into play too. There's the excellent simulations that Lightroom has of the different film profiles.
Mm-hmm. Just interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
When you talk about default settings, do you mean the default Lightroom settings,
which come with like 25 sharpening? Lightroom, every RAW file in Lightroom gets a default of 25 amount in sharpening. Now, under the hood, that default is actually the number is the same for every camera, but 25, for example, for a Canon RAW file, under the hood can mean different things than for a Fuji RAW file. But in my opinion, the default of 25 is a bit on the conservative side. So if anything, I will generally increase at least the sharpening amount slightly as a default setting on my whenever I use Fuji files. And you can do that. I explained that in one of the in my first video. You can actually create a new default that for a specific Fujifilm camera will set the sharpening to 40, for example, instead of 25.
And you could apply it on import, for example, right?
Well, if you set the default, it's a default. So
it will
be the default for that specific camera model from then on. You could also, and that's another thing I discuss in the video, you could also create a preset that sets the sharpening to 40, and then if you're importing Fuji files, you apply that preset. It's two ways of achieving the same. The preset approach gives you a little bit more control if ever you would, you know, want to decide not to get that default in there, then you could choose to not apply the preset.
Mm-hmm. And now here we are talking all the time, I imagine, about the RAW files.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So You are also a great photographer yourself. This is, I think it's anyway. Yeah, this is the best combination, really, that you know all this under the hood, you know, behind the scenes kind of Lightroom tricks, and you are photographing yourself. So, I mean, this is the best way to actually grasp the whole process happening there. So, okay, we are getting now into very, very, you know, hot, dangerous territory, JPEG versus RAW.
Yeah.
And specifically with Fujifilm files, there is this ongoing discussion. So in your opinion, when I shoot, because you can do it right on the camera, when I shoot a RAW JPEG, I import the RAW file into Lightroom and I import the, and I apply the film simulation, the same film simulation to this RAW file, and I import the just the, you know, the JPEG file, which is already a ready JPEG with the simulation. And then I realize, looking at the image in Lightroom, that there are some corrections, some adjustments to be made. Specifically, let's talk now about, okay, let's say the highlights are slightly blown out, slightly, not something crazy. Just let's get it official here. Is there a huge difference in what you can do in such slight overexposure when you are working on the JPEG file and on the RAW file?
There always is. I mean, if basically it's if an area is, you know, RGB 255, 255, 255, so which means that all three channels are blown out, then there's nothing you can do in RAW and in JPEG. But what the difference is that if there's what Lightroom's highlight control tries to do, if there's still information in two or one of the color channels, then it can use that information to kind of guess what the other channels would have to be like, and it will create a more detail in those highlights. And the thing is, with a RAW, you have a lot more different steps. So there's a lot more information for Lightroom to work with in trying to recreate that difference or that detail. So same goes for the shadows, by the way. It will let you bring up shadow detail without increasing noise. Now, and especially, for example, if you wanna do black and white conversions after the fact, then I would definitely recommend shooting in RAW, because you can apply a nice now the new Acros look is really nice, but the problem is, say you shoot you photograph somebody with a who's wearing a blue jeans, and he's it's a model, let's say, and she's wearing a red top. Well, in Lightroom, if you shoot RAW, it's very easy to pick the RAW, the red slider, drag it all the way down, and darken the gray value of that top. And in the meantime, you know, drag the blue slider up and increase the gray value of the jeans. You can go into complete extremes without messing your end result up. If you would do the same thing on a JPEG, it will start to look very messy and pixelated, because there's a lot less levels that Lightroom can work with.
I'm always on the fence, because and I think many of the Fujifilm users are, because the everybody is talking about how great the JPEGs
are. They are.
And in the end, we hear the arguments to actually dump them. I mean,
I would say that's the reason why let me give you a little anecdote. As you may know, I was one of the 100 lucky guys who got the X-Pro 2 a couple of months before the official launch, and then we were asked by Fujifilm I had to give them four images, and they said preferably from different shoots, so I couldn't do like tack 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 and here's your four images. I had to do four different shoots with them. And there was, at that time, there was no RAW support for the camera, so I had to shoot JPEG, so I was like paralyzed because I knew the whole world would be watching those images, and me as a self-declared raw lover, I had to shoot JPEG, and I was, and this maybe contradicts a little bit what I just said, but I was really surprised by what I could pull out of the JPEGs, especially if you choose the fine setting, the large file and the fine quality setting. I was really surprised by what you could get out of it. But still, a couple of those shots, I couldn't get out of them what I wanted. And then later, when the RAW support became available, I reprocessed those shots.
And you managed to save to.
But I think the best is if you're on the fence, shoot both. I mean, and import them, but then you should import them as separate images into Lightroom. Not as so-called sidecar files. And I can imagine, for example, a wedding photographer who doesn't want to spend hours and hours in post, that he would import both as separate files and that he would kind of use the RAW file as a backup for those rare instances where the JPEG has blown highlights or clipped shadows and he wants to recuperate those, or for when he wants to make advanced black and white conversions.
The only problem here is the backup file is much bigger than the original.
Well, if you shoot compressed RAW, it's not that bad. I think they're about 25 megabyte per image.
What is exactly the compressed RAW? I mean, in terms of the final quality.
It doesn't do it's a lossless compressed. So
could you quickly explain? I was always if you know about it, because I was always wondering, if it's a lossless compression, then where is the compression?
Well, basically it's like, when I don't know the fine details about it, but it's just a method like for example zip, you know, the zip compression that everybody sends now, zipped files of whatever. It's just a way of restructuring the data in the RAW file, that it's more logical and that it uses less zeros and ones, basically, to use that same information. Like a Lightroom catalog, for example, is a nice example. An LRCAT file can be compressed losslessly up over 80%. So that's why now in the recent Lightroom versions, the catalog backups are compressed, because it saves place. Now, the disadvantage of compression, even lossless compression, might be that it requires a little bit of extra computational power to decompress the file. And for example, some RAW converters, at least at first, I don't know how it is now, but they, like Capture One at first, I think, only read the original RAW files. It didn't read the compressed RAW files. I think it does now, but I'm not sure.
So probably it needs a little bit more of computing power and a fraction of time.
That might be.
Because I was wondering otherwise, why would they actually offer those two versions? They could just offer the compressed RAW as a standard, right? Yeah, and there would be no confusion.
No, that's right. But I think, I mean, if you're using Lightroom, definitely I would use the compressed version. It's a nice compression. It's no loss of quality whatsoever. And it brings them a little bit closer to the JPEGs. And because a fine quality JPEG can easily be 7, 8, or even, depending on the detail in the file, 10 megabyte too. So
So the difference is not huge.
Not crazy. I mean, if you buy an X Pro 2 or an X-T2 or whatever, I mean, you don't buy a Fuji because it's a cheap camera. So I would expect you to have a little money left for buying a couple of extra hard drives in that case.
Pete, I have the feeling you will have enough material, you know, for a couple of Lightroom for Fujilove Academy videos. So because you seem to be knowing those things really, really in depth. Let's touch a little bit. We have a bit of time on your work as a photographer, because this is actually what's all mainly about, I would say. So what are you into mainly photographically?
Well, I love travel and I love portraits and I love, therefore I love travel portraits. So that's what I would want to do all day if I could. But since 3 years, I'm the very proud father of a son, which means that, you know, I still travel, but not as much as I could be and wanted to before. So I still do one or two workshops a year, mainly in India with another Fujifilm ex-photographer, Matt Brandon. And but that means, yeah, I have come to kind of substitute that a little bit of the lost travel time. What I'm very much into now is urban exploring. So it's basically like traveling, but you can more like
traveling locally
and also locally. Like Belgium is full of and the neighboring countries are full of exciting urban exploration opportunities. And what I like to do, especially because there's like two kinds. There's just the, you know, photograph the building itself and the inside of the building, but I like to bring models, mainly dancers and other creative people, into those abandoned buildings and then use my my flashes and light them in those urban environments. And that's something I've been picking up and I really love doing as well.
Yeah, it's a great project. You have already some shots of this project on your website?
I have a couple. A couple of the X-Pro 2 images for the campaign were shot in those locations.
Mm-hmm. So I will make sure, of course, we link to your to your page people can have a look. And so how did it happen for you in the past and when that you actually settled with the Fujifilm X system?
Well, in 2009, I think, I did a one-year bicycle trip with my girlfriend. We cycled through Turkey, India, Indonesia, parts of all those countries, not all of them, and Iran also. So, so that was quite an adventure.
Quite a trip.
And I had, at first, a D700 with me, with a big lens, and 2 months into the trip, I got frustrated because it weighed so much. So this was before the X system was there. And at that time, I have really seriously considered getting me the Leica M, which was at that, the digital M, which was at that time just released. And funnily, there were two reasons why I didn't get it. And the main reasons, well, three, you could say, the price.
You just added the price tag?
Yeah, the price. I could have lived with the price tag, but the main reason was it was manual focus. And as I use a lot of flash in my work, and I very often hold the flash myself, especially when I'm traveling, you know.
You would need a third hand.
To focus. So that was difficult. And another simple thing was that I love to give prints to people. I have a little, at the time it was a Polaroid. Now it's an Instax printer. But at the time I had a Polaroid printer. And the Leica M series, which cost 5,000 euros, was probably the only camera in the world that didn't support PicBridge, which was the standard that this printer used to, you know, print images. That kind of put the desire in me to have a smaller travel camera system. And then I think it was 2011 when the X100 came out, and 2012 when the X Pro 1 came out. And I said, this is what I need. Basically, it's like a Leica, but with autofocus. Although with the X Pro 1, not the world's best autofocus, but admittedly, still a better autofocus than the Leica had. And I contacted Fuji Belgium and I said, look, I like to travel. Here's some of my work. And then thanks to a guy who's also an ex-photographer, Ioannis, who already was working with Fujifilm. He kind of put in a good word for me too. And that got the ball rolling. And I've been, at first I still used my Nikons also for anything that had to do with flash. But now that flash on the Fuji is also finally getting where it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just... anyway.
I was just about to ask you, because you are also known as the Flash guy, yeah, in some way. So I was wondering, like, with all this your Flash, you know, excitement and experience, mm-hmm, that you actually went into the Fuji system, which at that time, not perfect, let's put it nicely, not perfectly compatible with all the Flash idea.
So imagine how highly I must have thought about all the other qualities of the camera for me to put up with that big inconvenience, because it really was a big inconvenience. So at first, what I did was I used a lot of ND filters up until last year, basically. So because I love shallow depth of field, I love shooting my 56 at 1.2. I didn't buy the 56 to shoot it at f/16. You know, right. And with the sync speed of 1/180th and now 1/250th, if you're in bright sunlight in India and you want to use the flash, you have to use f/16. No way I want to do that. So what I've been using up to now is lots of neutral density filters, and that made it work. It wasn't practical, but at least I could make it work. I also shoot a lot of the with the X100, because that has a sync speed of 1/2000 of a second, which makes that I don't have to use those ND filters all the time. And mm-hmm, then finally, a month or two ago, the wonderful people from Cactus, which make flash triggers, they made this new V6 Mark II, which I've written on Fujilove about, and which is one of the most commented blog posts I think I've ever done. And it,
I think the server was getting pretty warm.
So, and they basically, they have, if you're into flash photography, you really should check out that that review, because basically what they have done is they have made it possible that even when Fujifilm themselves did not yet support high-speed sync, they made it possible to shoot most Fuji cameras, I would say, not all of them, but most of them, at speeds up to 1/8000 of a second, mm-hmm, with flash. And for me, mm-hmm, that was a gigantic game changer. And now there are no more inconveniences left in the Fujifilm X system.
And now with the recent announcement of the new flash, the EFX 500, do you think Fujifilm is getting there in terms of
I will get me an EFX 500, but I hope in a way that it's good they have it. I mean, for on-camera work, like if you're a wedding photographer or if you want to use bounced flash, you will have TTL and high-speed sync natively, which will still be a little bit easier than the Cactus way of doing things, because that is it's a little bit more manual. It works perfectly, but you have to think a little bit more about it still. Now, one of the things that I hope they will change or will add to their flash system is some kind of controller. Because right now, if you want to use a EFX 500 remotely, you'll have to put another EFX 500 on your camera to control that remote EFX 500, which
this is an expensive trigger. Then
so it becomes very expensive. Yeah, it's like €1,000 to be able to trigger one light remotely.
Right, and the new flash, you can trigger it only optically,
also,
right?
I mean, I'm happy it's finally there, because I think it will also allow maybe third party developers. If Fuji doesn't do it themselves, third-party developers, now at least they will get to know Fuji's flash system, and they can start to develop stuff for it. Like, for example, Pocket Wizard or Godox or Fotix, which all make very good radio triggers for Canon and Nikon flashes. I hope that one of these guys, or maybe all of these guys, like RoboShoot already has, the American company, they have dedicated radio triggers. And then you would be able to use that EFX 500, maybe just get one of them and then use a commander unit on your camera and be done with it. And that would be great.
So then you would have to attach a kind of a receiver at the...
Yeah.
At the foot of the flash, right?
It would have been better if Fuji had just integrated radio into the flash, but they haven't. So,
Let's hope it happens in the future. Yeah. Pete, we could go forever,
yeah,
I think.
We could.
but we are fortunate enough to have you around the site, so people can, you know, connect with you and have a look at your reviews, academy videos, and articles on the Fujilove website.
Okay.
Just last thing, what are your next, the nearest photographic plans? You said you don't travel much, but are you going somewhere in the
I have a I have another workshop coming up in February where I will travel to Delhi and Varanasi in India with Matt Brandon. And much to our surprise, that workshop sold out in 1 hour. So that's,
I saw it. This is a world record.
We were very happy with that.
And you didn't have only one place, right?
We had six spots because we wanted to really limit it. Now we finally were going with seven people because the last participant wanted to bring his wife. And so we kind of made an exception. But we really want to give high-end education there, and that just doesn't work if you're 20 people running around, especially with all the flash stuff. So that's one thing I'm looking forward to. And then I have a project in which I will cycle. I have bought a foldable bike, and I will cycle through Belgium and discover some of Belgium's cities and the neighboring country cities with just a lightweight camera and a lightweight foldable bike and public transportation. So that's another thing I'm thinking.
Sounds fun, really. Yeah. Thanks so much, Pete. We are looking forward to seeing your images, new images from all the trips. And have a great night and see you around.
Yeah, thank you, Tomáš. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Fuji Love Podcast. Stay up to date with Fuji Love. Follow our Facebook page and join the Fuji Love Facebook Readers Group. Head over to www.fujilove.com for all the necessary information. Take good care, and we will talk to you next time.